If I leave unexpectedly during satsang, I'll be back. When I was a child, I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I remember, and I noticed this too in my own children and many other small children, that it was impossible for me to grasp that some things were good and some things were bad. You know how when you tell a child over and over again to do a certain thing and that that's good and that another thing is bad or not the thing to be doing, we don't do this or we don't do that, whatever the way is that it's said. It takes a long time to really adopt those points of view that some things are good and some things are bad. It takes constant brainwashing, so to speak, to get those points of view in place, doesn't it? Yeah, we see this in small children and we see this in ourselves, of course. And since I was raised as a Roman Catholic, I had an experience that was filled with a lot of wonder, but then also filled with a lot of things I didn't understand. And when I was a very small child, I lived in the U.S., and then when I was 7 years old, I moved to Bermuda. And I moved to Bermuda right around the age when children go to confession for the first time and make their first communion. But usually that's done with a large group. But instead of doing it with a large group, I did it alone. So the process of learning to go to confession and getting in the booth and talking about what I'd done wrong and receiving the penance for it. And then I also made my first communion alone. I was the lone communicant, and I made my first communion on Christmas Day, which is also very unusual, and I didn't wear a white dress. I wore a little black and white checked taffeta dress with a white piqué collar with red satin trim. And I marched up there, marched up the aisle. With all the pews filled of Christmas Day churchgoers. And you know, when I started to learn about sin, that some things, not only were they bad, but they were really bad. And then other things were good and they were really good. It didn't make much sense to me at all. And I developed an obsessive quality about it because I was told I needed to examine my conscience, which meant that I had to keep track of what was going on in my head, so to speak, in my thoughts and my emotional states and in my actions. And then I had to keep a log, you know, like I should have had some kind of QuickBooks program or something like that for keeping track of all my venial and mortal sins. But I didn't really need that because I was really good at doing it. I was obsessive and compulsive about it. Like my parents had told me not to pick my nose. So every time I picked my nose, I was sure it was a sin. And I'd go to confession and I'd say, oh, you know, I disobeyed my parents 500 times, or however many times I'd been picking my nose. So you see, I couldn't quite grasp the full import of what confession was. And what confession really is and always has been is a process of reconciliation. But you see, I could only learn from what other people knew. I could only learn from what the priests knew or my parents, no matter what I felt about it within myself. So when I went to confession the first time, it just felt like something horrible was happening. It just seemed so wrong, so absolutely wrong to think that I had all these bad things going on with me and that somehow they would be corrected through saying 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys or whatever the penance was. So, you know, this way we begin to look at things in terms of opposites, that some things are positive, some things are negative, some things are bad and some things are good, some things are beneficial and some things are harmful. These are inculcated in all of us from a very early age. And one of the important parts of the 12 inquiries process is that we get to come to peace with that. We get to be complete with everything in our lives, and we look at it in detail, but not as a process of confessing our sins, so to speak, but in seeing where we miss the mark, where rather than seeing something as awareness only, we saw it as positive or negative, good or bad, beneficial or harmful. So, you know, it's when I was 16 or so, I thought, well, I've had enough of this. I'm not going to the Catholic Church anymore. I love the ritual. I love the splendor. And because I was raised in the European church, it was very beautiful. There was a lot of ritual and splendor, and I really liked that. But the other, I really couldn't ever adopt in any kind of heartfelt way, because I knew that love was the basis of everything. That's all I knew. That's all I knew. And so when I had this dramatic shift occur for me, I didn't need to make the Catholic Church wrong any longer. I could just see the Catholic Church as holy, positive, basic space. And the city where I woke up, there was a big Catholic church called St. Bernard. So a few days after I woke up, I walked in the church and I went in and I sat down in the pew up in front. And I just felt I felt the true meaning of confession, of reconciliation. Reconciliation is that everything's reconciled. It all comes back into oneness. It's an indescribable, indivisible oneness, a holy, positive, basic space. And so when we talk about making direct changes in the 12 inquiries process in terms of seeing everything as awareness, this is the direct change we're looking for, where everything comes back into oneness. That's the most profound direct change we can ever have. So that if we've had conflictual feelings about different things we've been involved with, or like the Catholic Church or any other church or spiritual practice or teacher, or if we have relationships that we feel resentment about or whatever it is, it's this coming into the spaciousness of all of that that is important. Early in this process, I had a dream, a very profound dream about this, because I had spent a lot of my life cataloging my good things and my bad things and trying to develop the good and diminish the bad, so to speak. I would have dreams, and in these dreams, there was an authority that was always looking for me. It was always looking for me everywhere, like a law enforcement authority. And this is what point of view is. It's like a grand law enforcement authority. It was always looking for me and trying to get me in my dreams. And just as it would try to get me, I would escape somehow. I'd be locked up in a room, but then I'd fly out the window, or, you know, I'd go through the wall or whatever it was and fly off into infinite space. Well, then when this shift occurred for me, I had the most amazing dream, and in this dream, everything in my life that I had ever done that was wrong, I had been arrested for. They finally found me and they arrested me. And I went to a court, and first it was this enormous court that was completely contemporary and modern. And then the back doors of it opened. They were these immense doors about 50 feet high. And they they formed a slide that went down into an old-fashioned courtroom with wood wainscoting everywhere all over the walls. So we slid down these doors into this other courtroom. And when we got there, it was like all of these things that I had thought were bad about myself, no matter what they were, they just blended with total light. There was just no distinction. It was all indivisible. It was an indivisible reality of oneness. That all these things that I had taken myself to be, that I had been so hard on myself for, that I had, where I had always been feeling like I couldn't possibly be good enough, no matter what I did, they all reconciled in this wonderful sense of light. And there was a door wide open. I could have walked out of the courtroom. I said, I don't need to go anywhere anymore. Because it was, everything is this holy, positive, basic space. No matter what our actions are now, have been in the past, or will be in the future, our thoughts and feelings, our sensations, no matter what they are, they're one holy, positive, basic space. And, you know, we can look into this in a very clear way, because say positive actions really were something that existed in and of themselves. If they were something that existed in and of themselves other than just a label, or if bad actions were something that existed in and of themselves other than just as a label on pure space, then they would be something that we could pass along to each other. You know, we could trade them like commodities. You know how commodities are traded? Wheat, barley, oats, whatever, pig bellies, whatever it is. We could trade these enlightened qualities in some way. We could trade good qualities. We could trade bad qualities. But there's no way to ever really pass these on to anyone else because it's just a label on pure space. So they've never known existence as anything in particular. And just as they've not known existence as any particular thing, there's no one who has had them. So you see, all of it is only pure space. It's just inconceivable pure space with nothing else going on. And we can look at benefit and harm, positive and negative, in this way, that no matter what the label is, that label is pure space. And when we rest as awareness, what we do is erase the label. That's all. We erase the label. We don't give it any import or meaning. It no longer has any punch in terms of who we take ourselves to be, whether it's our personal identity or some kind of an object we're labeling. And we can look into any kind of label we apply to anything, like say the mountain out there. We've looked into the personal identity in depth and seen that we can't really find anything there that establishes substantiality about a personal identity. But if we look at the mountain, we can do the same thing. What makes a mountain a mountain? Where will we find its mountainous there? We can take it apart, the trees, the rocks, the dirt, the water, the space, and never do we find the mountainous of the mountain in any of its elements, because all these labels, no matter what they are, they're like a mirage. So when it comes to this most important of all matters, which is our own timeless freedom, it's very important for us to collapse the cave of hope and fear around that. Because just as we can find no source, dwelling place, or destination for beneficial and harmful actions, so too with hope and fear. When we hope and fear, we hope that we will achieve enlightenment and we fear that we won't. And what we're really hoping for is a destination of pure awareness, or whatever we call it, Buddhahood. We want that as our destination. And then we fear everything going on. We hope that we'll get it and we fear that we won't. We hope that we'll achieve this exalted state, and we fear that everything we think, feel, and do is getting in the way of that. So we fear all our points of view. So this is very important to collapse the false cave of hope and fear. Just as benefit and harm are only labels on pure space, so hope and fear are labels on pure space. There is no one who is going to be Buddhified, so to speak. There's no one, just as there's no one to attach the label of benefit and harm to, there's no one to be Buddhified. It's all pure space. So you see, this is the collapse of everything into basic space, the collapse of everything whatsoever into basic space. And then the fear that our points of view stand in the way of that, in other words, that nirvana is something to achieve and samsara is something to do away with. Here we have, you know, this conflict of one thing or the other, of good versus bad. But both nirvana and samsara are transcended as wholly positive basic space, so that we have nothing to uphold. That's the point I'm getting to here. There's absolutely nothing to uphold. As I repeat over and over and over again, the only freedom there is this freedom in the immediacy of perception. That is Buddha nature. That is pure awareness. Whether we call it Buddha nature, pure awareness, the absolute, or whatever we call it, it is timeless freedom, and there's never been anyone who is not free. Do you understand what I'm saying about this? There's never been anyone who is not free, and there has never been any label that can be applied to pure space that is also not entirely free. One of my sisters died about 10 years ago, and she was 10 months younger. So we had been very close all of our lives. And when she died, it was as though she was more alive than ever. It was just like the label had been erased. The label disappeared. Then there was just pure space. So you see, we can only realize this when we come to a definitive conclusion about it, free in the immediacy of every perception. We can't come to a conclusion about it in any other way. We can't think ourselves into it. So when we look into our points of view in the process of the 12 inquiries and come to such a clear understanding about their true nature, then we not only complete all the loose ends about the practical goings on in our lives, but we come totally to rest as ourselves. We see there's no one and there's no destination of someone going anywhere, like towards enlightenment. We see that all these activities of our lives that we've been juggling, good and bad actions, that they just completely fall away, and they come to complete peace, because this reality of peace and freedom and immediate perception are equal. They're entirely equal. It's as though all those parts of ourselves that we thought, all our points of view that we thought were kind of a wasteland, that all of a sudden they have little bluebirds chirping and flowers growing. And this is such a relief. It's a huge relief. And sometimes it takes a while to really settle into that. That we really are just beautifully pure from the beginningless beginning, that really we are originally pure. We've never been flawed or marked by anything such as sin, karma, reincarnation, bad or good actions, none of that. And when we've spent many, many years looking at ourselves in any way other, in ways other than that, or adopting extremes about who we are, like we're non-existent, everything's illusory or whatever it is, then it may take us a little while to settle into that. But that's okay. That's okay. There was someone here at Satsang yesterday, Brahmachari, and afterwards he said to me, I realize more and more I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything and I don't have any expectations. He said everything's just more and more blissful. So even though we begin by resting naturally to recognize the essence of our own awareness as every single point of view, very quickly we're resting without needing to do so. So it isn't a lifelong project of developing a good action of resting naturally. It's just a way of settling into ourselves in a very direct way, a very direct and uncontrived way. See, all of these things, the methods and practices where we feel we have to do something to attain enlightenment, like meditate for endless hours, put ourselves in a certain state through certain other bodily postures, or to do pujas, or whatever it is we think we have to do to be good or get enlightened. Do you see how all of those are exactly the same as a world of opposites of good and bad? Every single point of view, no matter what it is the ultimate meditation. And every single point of view, no matter what it is the ultimate puja. It's that simple and it's that direct. So we need to come to this conclusion in ourselves and really be willing to rest wherever we are, even though there may be many other people who are not doing so. Because, I've seen this in my own life, that more and more people are resting. And as more people rest, it influences others to do the same. Because it's just like all of you, when you go home, your friends and family will notice a change. They will really notice a change. And some of them will ask you about that. What happened, they'll say. And I want that too, some of them will say. Others won't care. Some will. What's most important is that you care, that you care for yourself in this ultimate way. By just allowing yourself to come to total peace, by reconciling yourself as indivisible pure space. So you see, all of these things can be looked at in an ultimate way. Any practice we've done, if it's Catholicism or any other, it's just like what was called confession in the Catholic Church. I now understand the ultimate meaning of that. I really understand the ultimate meaning of that. It's just the complete reconciliation of everything as pure space. What could be better than that? Are there any questions?
Yeah. I have some fear with my mother, because if she sees me changed, she will quickly think some devil have captured me, or I'm hypnotized by somebody, or she's always negative, so it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. It's stay in touch with me when you actually see her and let me know what's going on there. You know, it'll, you'll be amazed. you know, when I had this shift occur 24 years ago, I didn't have much to do at the time, so I did a lot of wandering aimlessly around where I lived. I lived on this exquisite bay in Northern California, right on the ocean. And so I loved to wander around down by the fishing docks, which are quite extensive along this bay. And there were many people living down there in the weeds by the fishing docks and drinking Ripple and Thunderbird. And you know, this is just where they lived, and this was their expression of life to be doing that. And so, you know, when I first woke up, I was so innocent. You know, I had no idea what happened, first of all. Plus, all I felt was total love for everyone, everywhere I went. So pretty soon, you know, I had a lot of these people following me around, because everywhere I went, you know, it was, oh, you know, you're so beautiful. I love you so much. So pretty soon, they were following me around and wanting me to help them get their social security checks and, you know, all of these other things. So I could have spent a lifetime doing that, right? And there would have been nothing wrong with that, of course. It would have been just great. But you see, if I had just allowed myself to do all of that, then I wouldn't be here today. But instead, I knew that my purpose was to find a way to make this directly accessible to everyone, because that had also awakened in me. What is this, and how can everyone know they are this? Because I didn't even know what it was. So I said, what is this? What is this, and how can everyone know they are this? So rather than getting caught up in these sidelines, of which there are many, we all know that, I just stayed with this one purpose. I was very clear about that, because you know, when this love opens, it is all inclusive. It really is all inclusive, but it doesn't mean that we need to do everything that's before us. It's another thing that came up for me is that I just wanted to share this with everyone. I wanted to share with everyone the great reality. But you know, what I knew very quickly was that very few people want to hear about the great reality. So then I really started doing it the easy way. I just waited for people to come to me who wanted to hear, who, you know, saw something and then were really moved to want to live as this reality itself. And then they'd naturally come to me without me mounting a public relations campaign or trying to advertise and haul people in who really didn't want to hear what I had to say. So in this way, it makes life a lot more effortless. Do you understand what I'm saying in that? Yeah. Because when we open up as total love, well, then there are so many places we can express that love. And if we just really stay with the essence of our being, we'll know what our own form of expression is in a very direct way. Any questions?
How did your relationship change with all your cocktail buddies after you broke up?
Well, a lot of them I didn't see anymore, but I wasn't seeing them because I lived in a new location. So all these things happened at once, where I really no longer was part of the same scene, so to speak, that I'd been in. But then, of course, I had many years of knowing people, and What I found in a very practical way is that there was just this realization that who I am, everyone is. And just as the opportunity is available to me to be who I am, it's available to everyone, but without any assessment of right or wrong about what anyone's doing or involved in. So, you know, I've seen my children's father is an attorney, and he has remained in the same law firm all of this time from when we were young. And so, you know, I see these people growing old who were my cocktail buddies, and most of them, in fact, all of them, I think, are still cocktailing, and many of them to an excessive degree. So, you know, I just see that they're all beautiful. They're beautiful cocktailers. And then once in a while, someone would see the change in me, and then they'd feel moved to ask me about it. Or I was very young when I woke up, so, you know, there was a beach I went to near where I lived, and when I started going to the beach, I was no longer over enjoying alcohol, and there were lots of other people my age who went to the beach, and they'd carry those flasks with them to the beach with wine and other things in them, and then they'd just sit there all day and get obliterated. Now, if I had known about that kind of lifestyle when I was drinking, I probably would have taken it up. But I'd go down there every day, so they noticed that I wasn't drinking. That was the first thing they noticed about it. They were all drinking and I wasn't drinking. So then people would ask me about that. And then there was just this very natural segue, and pretty soon there were three of them who weren't drinking anymore either and who were realizing the essence of who they are. So it's a natural attraction. It is whatever it is. But when it comes to some of these things that are called addictions, well, really, the huge addiction is point of view. We know that. That's the primary form of addiction, taking point of view to be something other than awareness. That's the primary addiction. So if we talk about any addiction as a specific something, like alcoholism, drug addiction, some of the other ones that are talked about these days are sex addicts or food addicts or whatever it might be. It's easy to get caught within that label of a particular addiction, but the way to put an end to all of this is just to rest naturally. Then all of these addictions that we believe we've had, they come to rest too, but they come to rest only through our own rest. Many of us know that if we've had any of these addictions that are overt, that no matter what we try to do about them, we can't stop. And if we do stop, we replace it with something else, like trying to develop good qualities and diminish bad qualities. So the easy way is to just rest naturally, and then they all come to peace in and of themselves. It's impossible to affect a point of view with another point of view. If we believe in one point of view, say that alcohol makes us feel good, and we counteract it with another point of view that says not drinking alcohol makes me feel even better, we end up nowhere. We end up absolutely nowhere. Or drinking is bad and not drinking is good. We'll see, we just have more of the world of opposites, and that can never really bring anything to peace. But when we rest naturally, we find that's the basis of coming to peace with all our addictions to point of view, no matter what kind of shape they take. Or, you know, some of the people that I've met over the years, quite a few, in fact, maybe 20 or 30, that's quite a few, have been addicted to thinking about suicide as a way out. And some of the people had actively attempted suicide and others not. But this is another form of thinking, you know, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of this soup of point of view. It feels totally uncomfortable. Let me out of here. I don't know how to get out. And the only way I can see to get out is to just die, you know, erase the label of me. And that's, people do that, of course. And there really isn't any good and bad in it, but there's no way out of awareness. You know, we are awareness no matter what, and we can live as awareness, and that's the complete relief. So if we've had this point of view of obsessively thinking about suicide, even if it's just from time to time, as a way out, and you'd be surprised how many people think about it. It's amazing. Almost everyone has thought about it at least once. So that really normalizes things, doesn't it? Just let me out. None of these things that I've thought were true are true. This is all we're saying. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to live from point of view. So, you know, when if we've been having these thoughts of suicide as a way to soothe ourselves, then when they come up, it's important to just rest naturally and allow ourselves to be who we are while they arise. They will diminish and completely collapse in basic space, I guarantee you. No matter what your favorite points of view are. All of these favorite points of view, so to speak, whether it's trying to be a good person or people, for example, who are serial killers, a person who is a serial killer is motivated by exactly the same thing that a person who is accumulating meritorious actions. Did you know that? They're motivated by seeking relief through either good or bad actions. But with the serial killer, the only way that the serial killer can feel relief from mounting anxiety is to murder. So the only way a person who needs to accumulate meritorious actions can find relief from the anxiety of everything going on is to continue to put together meritorious actions, when all the while the only solution is awareness. So you see, when we say, well, if we lock people up in prisons, it'll stop them from doing harmful things, and then they'll become better people, and we can put them out and they won't commit crimes anymore. We all know that doesn't work. It doesn't work because, you see, the only thing we can do is to teach people how to rest naturally. And, you know, there are people who wake up on death row, these people who are serial killers, and they wake up in the same way we're talking about here. They have to come to the definitive conclusion that all they are is pure space. That, you know, this is really the only way to rectify and really come to peace with what has occurred. It's the only way to come to complete peace with what has occurred. It doesn't state what has occurred is right, or that this should go on pell-mell. It just means that this is the basis for the person reconciling with everyone and everything as pure space. This is the only hope whatsoever for rectifying criminal behavior, so to speak. All these other strategies are just dead ends, just like all the strategies with ourselves where we're trying to correct one habit with another point of view, trying to correct one point of view with another point of view. It almost never works. If it does, we're still not at complete peace. Maybe we're not doing what we were doing, like we're not drinking, but we're not at complete peace by any means. We're not totally free as wholly positive basic space just by quitting a habit. So you see, if quitting a habit actually led somewhere that was totally free and wonderful, then we'd have something to say about doing so. But because it's only a label that is entirely without cause and effect, there's no way that it can cause anything or affect anything either. So we can only come to a complete realization about this by resting naturally in each perception. It's good to have these understandings, these pivotal understandings that I'm talking about here, and have the key points laid out in a very direct way, but we then must decisively experience it. So everything you hear from me here or that you listen to on the satsang CDs after you go home, incorporate that into your own direct experience as you rest naturally. And it will become more and more alive for you. What might initially just be an understanding, an aha, oh yes, more and more you'll see it in your own experience. Well, we'll see when someone feels moved to do that. Yeah. There'll be someone who... Would anyone here like to do that? You would, all right. That was easy. Pardon? It is. Well, you know, there is no teaching like this in prisons. I can guarantee you that. Oh, you've done that already?
I haven't taught it, but I just know that they've had approval to do it around the world. That's taught in a 10-day format.
Yeah.
So it would just be a matter of, I'll work there in prison for 6 years. Seen it all?
Oh.
I think it'd be a great thing.
Oh, it would be such a great thing. It would be such a great thing. First of all, it's quick. It's quick. So it brings such relief, and it's a place where great relief is needed. And because the entire circumstance is filled with so much intensity, it's a perfect place to practice resting naturally. So, you know, I know it would be of enormous benefit, and I know it doesn't exist because this is the only teaching like this. So, you know, it's a teaching that in a prison anywhere in the world, a person could understand the language of it. It doesn't have any terminology that's specific to a certain culture. It's about being human in the ultimate sense. And people who are in prison, they've been hearing how bad they are from everybody. Maybe it's been spread all over the newspapers. It's likely that it has. They've been sitting in this courtroom setting where it's entirely based on you're bad, 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 bad. And now we're going to send you to a place where everyone else is bad, 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 too. Right after I woke up, I met a person who was law enforcement official, and he started waking up, and he had been a prison guard and all of that, and he said, I'll tell you something about the people in prison. The guards and the prisoners, they're exactly the same. There's the bars. They're the same on both sides of the bars. So, you know, this is really, in terms of what humankind can do for itself, this is what we can do for ourselves. And in a culture like India, where this is so natural, resting naturally is very natural to the Indian way of life. People come to the Hindi satsang and they're there two or three times, like you, Manju, Vivek. And just that's it. You know, it's perfect. What I'm talking about is perfectly understood. And one man came to one of the Hindi satsangs, and he's a ship captain. So he travels all over the world steering a ship, a big cargo ship. And he said he spends a lot of time going around Asia to different ports, and he said China really needs the great freedom teaching. And the way he can assess whether or not a country needs a teaching is how they take care of their old people. And he said India is the only country in the world that really takes care of its old people. It's just ingrained in the culture. It's in the sense of community. And the welfare of everyone is the basis of life, rather than how am I going to build my self-esteem. You know, there is no Asian language that has a word for self-esteem. Not one. Because from the beginning of life, the focus is on the community and society rather than on the individual. Whereas in the West, our whole focus is on the individual.
Is that why I forget your wording, but you indicated that in the West, satsang is a tough audience. Is that the reason that we're so focused on?
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. And also the consumption of goods and the consumption of qualities that will enhance our self-esteem. So if a person comes to satsang to consume a good called enlightenment, and the purpose of that is to enhance their self-esteem, that's not the proper motivation. The proper motivation is to realize that all beings are already completely enlightened, including ourselves. And, you know, that's the starting point.
One more clarification. Uh-huh. You talked about criminals, and I love the visual of the prisoners aren't any different than the guards, but how do you apply that to someone like a Scott Peterson? And I only say that because I do think the man is somehow mentally ill. So how would you apply this to people who are mentally ill?
First of all, what I have to say about anyone who's arrested and convicted of something these days, we really don't know what's going on. Because from the beginning, there's this intense media campaign that's all based on good and bad and absolutely having to find the bad guy. So no matter what the media, which is now law enforcement, coupled with law enforcement in the West, is going to find the bad guy, no matter what. And they'll go to any lengths to find the bad guy, no matter what the evidence is. So we have to discern what's going on in a very clear way, that this whole mechanism of good and bad, it really skews things to the point where we have no idea what's really going on. So with Scott Peterson, we really don't know. He's been demonized by the media. We do know that. I've never met him, so I have no idea what's going on. I happen to be going to the San Mateo courthouse on another matter during the time he was on trial there. And I knew I needed to be there because I needed to see what was happening firsthand. And the entire courtyards of all these big courthouses were covered with media from all over the world. And they were all there to get this guy. You know, no one was there saying, well, let's really look at what's going on here. No one was saying that. So, but then, you know, this is a very important question, and it's certainly something that is very close to my heart, because there's not just Scott Peterson, but there are the other people, like the young man who murdered all the women in Yosemite, who just very viciously tortured them and murdered them. So of course, these people are awareness. That's what we know about them. I'm so clear on that. That's all they are, awareness. And I feel such immense compassion because I can feel what leads them to act. what leads them to act is just trying to get some relief from point of view. Whatever the mix-up of all their points of view are, all they're seeking is some kind of relief from point of view when these actions are taken. So there's that. And then there's, you know, capturing the person and locking them up and putting them in this process of the court system. And what can really serve? Well, I know what can really serve. So then I see this person who's already totally tortured by their own points of view. They have no idea that they're awareness. And then there's even more torture. It's mounting torture. Now it's the torture of all these other points of view. So, you know, there's no chance whatsoever of them ever coming to peace with themselves within that environment. So, you know, it's up to us. It's up to us to recognize these own things in ourselves and come to peace with ourselves as awareness. And then as each of us involved in this process called humankind do so, then we can reach out to these other people, whether they're Scott Peterson or whoever they are. And see, just sitting here today already, Michael, he wants to take this into the prison. So you see, this is the only way we can come to terms with ourselves as humankind. It's the only possible way. We've gotten nowhere looking at things as good and bad. That's never led to anything other than more chaos.
You know, I kind of feel confused if there's any such thing as history and future and stuff like that. But anyway, do you have any sense of why we came to think that we're not aware, why we're not aware of our awareness?
The human being only is self-knowing awareness, so it's the way that awareness knows itself. Self-knowing awareness is the way that awareness knows itself. That's all we need to know about that. And as far as history or time, you know, we are timeless freedom. It's entirely pure space without dimension of any kind. It's just like if we sent a bird into the sky that could fly forever, it would never find the perimeter of pure space. It would never find a center or any location within that was the source or essence or birthplace of pure space. So everything is this pure space. When we rest naturally, we realize that everything is that, and that in the ultimate sense, there is no history. There is no teacher, there is no student, and there is no teaching. We realize that to all be the case in the ultimate sense, but as the ultimate includes and contains everything, all points of view are also the ultimate. All points of view are also included. So we know everything not only in this ultimate sense, but we know it in detail. That means we can be completely at ease discussing history. We don't have to take on any kind of weird forms of speech that delete the use of the word I or me or mine or anything like that. We don't have to posture ourselves as any extreme. We can just be totally natural. No one will ever listen to any of this if it isn't totally natural. If it can't be expressed in just a natural way that everyone can understand and relate to their own life. It's just like, you know, when I woke up, oh, everything was perfect love. It's all the heart. It's, oh, the awakened heart. Oh, you know, it's all so devotional and glorious and beautiful. And, you know, so that's kind of my personal take on it, so to speak. It's just all just total love and beauty and glorious and that kind of thing. But you know what? Almost no one wants to listen to that crap. I had no audience for that one. So, you know, I realize that we need to communicate this in a way everyone can understand. So my two questions, what is this and how can everyone know this? Well, it's not going to come about through saying, oh, yes, oh, wow, gee, isn't it all so beautiful? It's all the awakened heart. That maybe 1% of the population would want to listen to that. But you see, when the truth is spoken in a common language that any human being can understand, then whatever our own personal disposition is, and we can just go ahead and have fun with that anyway. If it's devotion, if it's all-out love, or if it's more of an intellectual understanding and a specific way of describing that. But in the Great Freedom Teaching, it really combines all of those in an inseparable way.
This is just an observation. I've never been in a group workshop where no one's left. And that is because it's the truth. It's completely natural, and the languaging, I've done so many workshops, and even for Vipassanas, you know, where they make you sign a piece of paper, no, I won't leave, and it's absolutely amazing. All 12 of them have been committed and keep coming back, so that's just proof, isn't it?
It's good. Well, with each inquiry, there's just so much freedom experienced. You know, it's tangible. We may not know where we're headed or anything else, but it's tangible. It's felt. It's not just, oh, maybe something's working here. It's really directly experienced. So this is the only way we can measure a result. We feel a shift, even if it's a slight one, within us. Somehow things look a little different. Yes, it really is. It is great freedom, because no matter, you know, it's really ultimate freedom, because no matter what country we live in, we think of freedom in a certain way within the context of that national system. And then also when it comes to ourselves, we think of freedom in different ways. So, you know, the ultimate prison is point of view.
Everyone wakes up in prison.
Right, everyone wakes up in prison. Well, I've made a CD for children, and it's being made into a book right now. Mm-hmm. This is a very important concern for us as human beings, how to, from the beginning of their life, give children this reality rather than one based on point of view.
At what age could you start?
Very young, very, very young.
Like three?
The Tibetans start very young, as soon, like 5 or 7 children go to monasteries. In Tibetan families, there's always at least one child in a monastery, usually more. So I've read these accounts of children having the realization of utter lucidity when they're like 7 years old. And so all of these specific realizations within the total realization that we realize in the Great Freedom Teaching, that children already are so immersed in this, so it's very easy for them to realize it and devote their lives to it. But it has to be encouraged. It really has to be encouraged.
How young do you take them into intensives?
Pardon?
At what young age do you take them into intensives?
We've not had any children in intensives so far. We've just had the CD.
We have, those of us who are involved in the teaching who have young children, they're just exposed to the teaching.
Through the parents. But still, you know, it's a bit of a conflict because usually at school with their peers, the children are learning one thing. And then at home, they're hearing something else. And then sometimes there might be one parent who's totally free and the other parent is really into point of view. So we need to gradually come together and first have this realization for ourselves. Because see, unless we have the realization ourselves first, we can't integrate it into any of our social systems, no matter what they are, prisons, schools, or anything else. But we do want to start a school, and there are some people within Great Freedom who are actively considering that.
In what location?
It would probably be California, the first one. Mm-hmm. Although it could be India.
Mm-hmm. Children are born, are they born in front of you? Are they born in
free? Did you pop out going, I'm somebody and my name is Simon?
So we're sort of born in life and then we become point
of view and there at that. I don't know if you know, but there's an amazing lady, what's her name? She's the head of the police force. Very, very old lady. She might be very interested in the great thing.
Does she live here?
She's in
Derrida. In
Derrida.
And she's in education?
She is the head of this.
Head of the general police.
Ganjin Chaudhary.
Of what?
Ganjin Chaudhary. Her name is Ganjin Chaudhary. And she's the head of
IGO police.
Head of?
Police.
Police.
Police?
Yes.
Oh.
She's very interesting.
Oh. Thank you. Well, there wouldn't be some of the things we're seeing these days, like people bludgeoned by peace officers. But this can come about, you know, just like with the people in this room. This is why all of Great Freedom is based on a written teaching that is imbued with the liberating power. It is. We've seen it over and over again. So then people go out and share this with other people, and people wake up everywhere. But it can't be just one person, you know, like the rock star of awakening running around and trying to wake everybody up. It has to be grassroots, everyone working together. The rock star model of gurudom, it is passé. It always has been. So grassroots is the way to go. See, when it comes from the grassroots, then it just takes over everything like a tsunami. It starts in a quiet way. Any other questions? Vivek?
When you talk about resting naturally, are there chances of getting caught in the point of view again?
Is there a chance of getting caught in point of view
again? We talk about resting naturally.
Uh-huh. In the beginning, there may be, but maybe not. It just depends on the person. Sometimes someone comes to satsang, and right away, the first time, that's it. All the points of view are resolved in pure awareness. And other times, there will be points of view come up again. It just is what it is. What we need to do is gradually familiarize ourselves with resting naturally. If we have points of view come up again, then we need to rest naturally when those points of view come up. That's all that need occur.
Maharaj said it took him 3 years.
Pardon?
Maharaj said it took him 3 years from first hearing the message to his
father. Uh-huh, it took him 3 years, yeah.
Aren't we resting naturally?
Pardon?
Aren't we resting naturally?
We all are. We already are. That's why it's so effortless, because we already are completely at rest. That's our natural state. We don't have to do anything to be who we are. It's just like, you know, we don't have to do any methods or practices in order to get our eyes to be the color they are. They just are that. If we said, oh, I have brown eyes, but I really think I have to do a bunch of methods and practices in order to make my eyes brown, that would be insane, wouldn't it? So you see, we already are who we are. We just need to rest and recognize that as each perception comes up. We'd never be that cuckoo, would we, to say, oh. And in the Great Freedom Teaching, anyone who stays around here and commits to the Four Comforts, resting naturally, it takes no time. Either it happens right away or within a year at the outside in really difficult, demanding cases where people are really reluctant to give up their points of view, or maybe sometimes once in a while a person will want to adopt an extreme like non-existence or impartiality. I'll just do whatever I want. It doesn't matter what I do. I can blow up at anybody I want to. I'm perfectly free no matter what I'm doing. Well, that's just more insanity. That's like the anomaly of point of view that I've been talking about. But for most people, a year is at the very outside with commitment, but we have to be committed. There's no one doing anything to us. We're already timelessly free. We just need to recognize that more and more about ourselves and use the support available to do that. And when we do that, then, you know, we really realize who we are. It probably took Maharaj so long because He only saw his guru, I think, 3 times a year for a couple weeks a year, and then his guru died. And then he adopted an extreme. He said, I need to go sit in a cave, or I need to be a sadhu. So he had a string of very successful bidi shops, you know, those little cigarettes. And or not a string, a chain, that's what they're called, a chain string. But, and you know, he had a family and everything, a children and a wife, and so he just left them all and he went off wandering around as a sadhu. And after he'd been out for a while, about 10 months or 9 months, he ran into one of his one of his guru brothers from his guru. And the guru said, the brother said, you know, what are you doing out here? He said, oh, I left my family. I'm going to find the truth. And, you know, I left all my bidi shops. And the guy just said to him, you know, our guru would never approve of that. You go home and you take care of your family and your bidi shops. And that's just the way it has to be. So then he did that. He went back and fulfilled his commitments. And then in that, he woke up. And then, you know, by the time he got back, he only had one bidi shop left. And his family, they were very happy to see him, and people would come into his beady shop and he'd talk to them about the Absolute. They could see that something had changed in him. So then his children built another story on top of his beady shop, and that's where he had satsangs. He could only have 30 people or so there. And eventually they came from all over the world to see him.
With stuff like alcohol, you're talking about commitment, but with stuff like alcohol, I come from a very big drinking culture where, you know, my work and my friends, you know.
Oh.
So, I mean, do I need to say to myself, that's it, I'm not going to drink again as part of my commitment? No, if you tell me to do it, I will, but I don't know if I need to. Do I need to do that?
Well, I don't know if you need to do it, but you know. What do you think?
I think that probably I can have a couple of beers and rest naturally. I don't know. As long as I'm not blowing myself off.
You'll find out.
You know?
Try it. Have a couple of beers and see if you can stop.
Right. Okay.
If you can't stop, you know, some of us know something about that. Yeah, I tried that one, you know, to have a couple. I had someone who said, I was trying to stop drinking, so someone said, okay, you know, just have a couple of drinks. And I said, you know, I really don't think I have a problem with alcohol. And she said, okay, well, that's fine, you know, just have a couple of drinks and see what happens. So I went home, and the first night I had a couple of drinks, and I called her up, and I said, oh, you know, I had a couple of drinks, that's fine. The next day, I had about 10 drinks, and I called her and told her I'd had a couple of drinks. You know, I was trying to look good. But so, you know, we can only see the evidence in ourselves. Again, it's our direct experience, and then through your direct experience, you'll know what course to take.
We were talking about this last night. Actually, I brought it up with the answers, and a lot of my old friends that are males, that's how they socialize. So a lot of your friends just get together and drink. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's a very Aussie culture anyway. So for me, when I stopped drinking, I stopped seeing a lot of friends.
Yeah.
Who I really enjoy having a laugh with, you know, I really enjoy their company, but it was just that, and I don't have an answer for that, because I go surfing with them sometimes, but that's the way they always knew me as well.
Sure.
So for men, you know, I felt it's been very hard, and it felt impossible. It brings with its challenges.
Sure. Well, the challenges are infinitely easier resting naturally. They're so easy because it doesn't really matter what other people are doing. Keep the focus on yourself and your own natural rest. And what it boils down to is that we're either committed to point of view or we're committed to awareness. So if we decide we want to do some more research on point of view, we can do that too. You know, we can go out and do some point of view research. Like, oh, I don't know about this resting as awareness BS. Now that I'm back at home here, I think I'm going to do some more research on point of view. We'll find out very fast that, you see, to go back to point of view when we have a head full of this, resting naturally, there's no way to ever undo this. What you'll have now is a whole bunch of point of view and this, and that is really intolerable. You know, when it's just point of view, it's intolerable enough. But when you have point of view and this, and they're all mixed together, You have no choice but to rest. Pardon?
We all swallowed the blue
pill. Yeah, that's right. We all swallowed the blue pill. That's from The Matrix, if you haven't seen The Matrix. There are three films, by the way. You know, there are many people in all cultures who don't drink, and I was in a drinking culture as well, but mine was more like the country club set. And then I noticed when I woke up that most people don't drink. Really, most people do not drink.
What about vegetarianism?
What about it? It doesn't matter a bit. When everything resolved in basic space for me, it was just, I'd run into all these methods and practices like vegetarianism, not eating meat, different brands of vegetarianism, meditation, whatever it was. And I just think, well, why are people doing this? You know, if they want to get enlightened. Everything is pure space, so it really doesn't matter. And you know, so once in a while there's a crazy wisdom type guru who, they're just full out alcoholics and everything else, but you know, today we don't need that. We don't have time for that nonsense today. If you're a crazy wisdom guru, get over it. That's what I have to say. We don't have time, we really don't. We don't have time to confuse people with that kind of stuff.
How can, what do you mean,
why don't we have time? Well, I'll name a few very practical examples. The world is on the precipice of global nuclear war. The ozone layer is depleting, the oceans are rising. Most of the people in the world have nothing to eat. 40,000 children die of starvation every single day. The world is becoming more and more populated. Every day more and more people die of starvation. So those are some practical examples of why we don't have time. A few people in the world have all the resources and think they're right about everything, and most of the people have nothing. You know, they can't even put together a route to make some tea during the day. So, you see, we have not been able to resolve any of these issues from point of view. We have not been able to resolve any of them, but we can resolve them by all coming together and realizing our true nature. You see, enlightened qualities are not at all evident when we're living from point of view. So we can't really see the solutions to these problems. But as enlightened qualities become obvious, then we can see solutions that never existed, like the Great Freedom Teaching, for example. But just as we can see something like the Great Freedom Teaching, a teaching like no teaching that has ever been, that applies to all humankind, so we can see something we didn't even know was here as a way to feed everyone, or provide clothing for everyone, or shelter for everyone, or clean water for everyone. Most of the people in the world have no clean water to drink. You know, there are very few people in the world who have clean water. Or, you know, waste management, health care, education. We from Western culture have that in many of those things in abundance. But are we free? No, not at all. In fact, we're enslaved. We spend our entire lives looking for personal comfort and defending our realm of personal comfort. No one's going to get inside my space of personal comfort that I've put together for myself. So, yeah. Pardon?
Aren't we living in timelessness?
We are timeless. We're entirely timeless. But to say that we're timeless only, then we adopt an extreme. You know, we do not need transcendence of the body. Transcendence of the body, there have been no more people anywhere in the world who have transcended the body than China, Tibet, and India. But has that provided food? For half of the world's people live in Asia. Has that provided food for half of the world's people? No, because it's an extreme. Transcendence is an anomaly of point of view. It's just another point of view. So when we say we are timeless freedom, we don't adopt an extreme of that. We include everything. Because see, this is the only way for the omniscience of enlightened intent, of holy positive intent to come alive. Then all the economic problems of these cultures can be resolved. But if we're looking for a way out, you know, that's no different than drinking a bottle of vodka every day. Having a bottle of vodka every day won't solve any of the problems of the world, but splitting off from the body won't either.
When you talk about there are people who are holding the resources, we have the resources.
Uh-huh.
Isn't it been the case for long? If you even go to the animal world, this is the same thing.
Pardon? If you go where?
Into the animal world.
Oh, into the animal.
Same things. I mean, the most powerful will have all the resources, and others will have to die around. He'll snatch the things around. The most powerful ones will go in and snatch the things, and the people who are not that much powerful, or the animals who are not that much powerful, they will die around. This seems to be the case all around, and for the past many thousands of years.
That's a point of view that's perpetrated by Western philosophy. It really is. It's a point of view that's perpetrated by Cartesianism. So, you know, if we look at something like, and by Darwinism, so, you know, we don't need to look at things in such a limited way, in such a totally limited way. There is no power structure or hierarchy in timeless awareness. So all of these points of view we've adopted from other people, and now, of course, Darwinism and Cartesianism are spreading throughout the world. They're not just in the West. We need to rest as awareness and see what enlightened body, speech, and mind have to say rather than what everyone else has to say. You know, if I had been constantly trying to incorporate what everyone else had to say, there would be no great freedom teaching. At some point, everything comes to a stop and you just say, well, you know, enlightened mind knows what it knows. It can see everything as it is and bring forth something that never existed before. So, you know, this can be used to solve all the world's problems. Not just this very pivotal problem of enlightenment. Because you see, we can't muster any solutions from point of view. We really can't. And to say, oh, this is just the way it is, it's the way that animal systems are, some are powerful, others are not, that's to give up. You know, that's hopelessness, that's fatalism, that's dismal. That's no fun to get caught up in these things. It's I think, therefore I am. As though, you know, all these thoughts somehow how are who we are. So if we think well about all these things, we'll have some kind of a good result. But, yeah. So, you know, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the sense of what's going on a global perspective. This is why I really emphasize to keep the focus on yourself. Allow that transformation to occur right here, and then your own potency will affect other things in life. But we have to start here. Are there any other questions? We'll sit quietly.